afternoon.
I'm John Manley from Abingdon, and I'm an appeal from Washington County Supreme Court on the Worth matter. I represent Taylor Moret, the appellate case. We're here today, Your Honor, we're raising three issues in this case. One, that the court, when it found that there was a change in condition to review and modify the child support, and other support should have gone back to 2008 instead of 2012 in the case. Two, that the circuit court in awarding the $1,000 in spousal support in this case did not use the most accurate figures that were present and chose it instead to rely on a bankruptcy court estimate on Schedule I of income in it. And then finally, three, in the equitable distribution award in this case, the court failed to take into account marital debt and debt that would have not entitled to a $45 credit in the case. Those are principally our arguments we're raising in this matter. The Moretts separated in 2006. This was a long, protracted divorce matter. Many, many attorneys on it. Ms. Esposito and I are the final ones in this case trying to get it resolved. So it was hard case to put together from that standpoint. In regard to issue one on the case, the parties, when they separated, they entered into an agreed order for spousal support at $2,250 and $2,250 for child support. Ms. Moret at that time was had a trucking company, trucked cattle to the feedlots out west, and was doing very well at that point in time. That was in May 1, 2007. Ms. Moret then filed a motion in August 2008 asking for a modification of the order. And then there was another motion, October 2008, asking for an order
to modify this. And again, you have a lot of ground to cover, so I'm going to try to help you as best I can, sure. Maybe with some of the ground that may be most compelling and confusing. It seems, and help me out if I mistake the facts, you know the case better than I do probably, but it seems that there was some sort of pendente litae orders entered in 2008 to kind of maintain the status quo, for lack of a better way of putting it. And there was a pendente litae order that was entered in January of 2009 without prejudice. Am I right up until that point?
Your Honor, my reading of the record is that the October 14th, 2008 orders were resolved on January 7th, 2009, and another agreed order that said they were entered without prejudice,
right,
as to the pending motion.
And then you had a March 2011 order that was in it, which was,
yes,
in the nature of a final order, correct?
Your Honor, and that's the finding of the circuit court judge that was in the nature of the final order. But that order simply said that he found nothing at that point in time to change the order entered on January 7th, 2009, which was, in the strange, convoluted manner of this case, was the order entered without prejudice. Nothing was said about the prior motions in this case. So we feel like the court speaks to its orders, and we give full credit to all the wordings of the orders and other things, that the court should not have stopped in 2012, should have backed up to 2008.
But I think you'll agree with me on this, there's no methodology in the context of a case like this to appeal a pendente litae order. It's not a final order, it's just a maintained status quo kind of order. And once you enter a final order of divorce, which apparently was entered in March of 2011, all right, that made essentially, now while a judge may adopt what's in the pendente litae order, basically the pendente litae order becomes a nullity, and the final order of the March 2011 becomes the final order of the case.
Well, Your Honor, I don't see how the March 2011 order could be the final order in the case. The divorce was granted in 2017, but that order again said there was just no reason to modify the January 2009 order.
Yes, sir.
So I don't see how it could be any finality to it without going back and having some specific language to that effect. Now, the court did in its letter of opinion state that he felt that that order did resolve those other matters. But he was the second judge of the case, as far as that goes with it. That went behind the express language of the order. So we have this odd situation in which this order does not really set out what happened in the case. And you can't really go behind that order and say, well, what happened in this case? I know there were multiple hearings on motions and on these motions modified. But as my client told me, that it was several were behind closed doors, so they came out and worked these things out. So what evidence the court had or whatever, if that worked out, I don't know what it had in there, but I do, my reading of the case, Your Honor, is that Mr. Barrett, being an owner a trucking business. His income had to be calculated every year when they did the taxes and all that. And they were keeping this issue open until they could find out what, you know, his income really was. And it wasn't until we presented evidence in this case through CPA that what the real actual earnings were during that time period, that the court really had that information before. And I think that the finding, and the court didn't make those findings in 2017. So when it backed up in this case, it should have backed all the way up before that to the dates of the original motion.
Were you counsel in 2011 or was someone else counsel?
Somebody else was counsel, Your Honor. Your Honor, I'm basically a bankruptcy attorney, and Mr. Murphy was a bankruptcy. I took over this case because I felt like somebody needed to do something to try to round it up. And so here I am.
Well, we appreciate it.
Well, I don't know whether I appreciate it, but it's been an interesting.
But typically, when we're looking at divorce cases like this, we don't, unless there's something unusual, take a look at what happened pendente litis. That's not a concern. We focus on the final order. And if we were to take your argument to its logical conclusion, the best circumstance would have been that in the March 2011 order, there would have been some language talking about adjudicating the rearages going back to 2008, 2009. But for whatever reason, the trial judge said that the order that I entered back in January 2008 has nothing to do with this, and so therefore you're stuck with what's going forward from 2011. And the judge is entitled to interpret its own orders the way that it perceives them to be interpreted, whether it's the second judge or not. So that, doesn't that create a problem for us to go back and say, well, what the judge really meant when he said this is that we should go back to 2008?
But that's what the circuit court did in this case. It's reading into language that's not there. When you take the plain express language that was entered by the court in January 7, 2009, that language clearly said, that it's without prejudice to the pending.
But then the court said, there's no change of circumstances exist to alter the order the trial court entered on 1709, and the motion to amend said order is denied. That's what was said in that order.
Right. Sorry. Yeah, that's right. So, but that order still says it's entered without prejudice. So, that's where we are. I do admit it is a very strange circumstance, and I think the language probably was loose in that matter. I'm glad I was not counsel at that time. I'm sure Ms. Epstein was probably glad she wasn't counsel at that time. But it's where we are, so it's an odd conundrum.
Okay. Counsel, do you want to speak to the argument that the appellee makes in reference to whether this is preserved in reference to the arrears?
This issue?
Yes, about the arrears.
In my motion, I did argue in my motion to reconsider this. I mean, this is not a first instance argument for anything in this matter at all. In my motion to reconsider, I specifically raised this issue about those items. Now, the way that the argument is worded is I'm saying that the arrearages that's awarded for $76,000 on from 2012 is incorrect.
But
and
I
that's
think
because the court should have backed up further and revised it.
Right, but I think their position essentially is that was concluded in 2011 with that March order.
Yeah. Well, I think that it really, because it was without prejudice, I mean, I've raised that issue before the circuit judge. I think it's preserved for the record. I believe it is. And it's in my point one of my first motion for the court to reconsider on a written case. If we could move on from taking time to the spousal support order in this case, but the court expressly said in the order that he found that the amount of income that Mr. Barrett had was based on his 2012 bankruptcy petition. And Mr. Barrett's background, his trucking business failed. He had health problems. He lost all of his trucks except one. And his income lowered down than that. When you file a Schedule I in your bankruptcy schedule, it is an estimate of income for the future. And that all is an estimate. That same schedule has a schedule of expenses with it, too, that showed he had a negative $2,000-some deficit each month on what he had to pay out at that point in time. So I don't think the court really could follow one without the other. But there was other evidence, or probative evidence, that we submitted through a CPA who was an expert who went through all the tax returns of that and gave his testimony about what the available cash was each year going back to 2007, going forward up through 2014 is what was available for Mr. Russ to be able to pay in this case. And I think the court has to use the best evidence available and not just go and snatch out a figure from the bankruptcy petition and determine that's what it is. But place in the opinion itself that he put down that the figure was $3,200 from the bankruptcy petition, which equates out to about $39,000 gross income per year. But then he also said it was $28,000 below that, based on some testimony that was given. So, but the figure he was using was the $39,000. So I don't think that on the face of it, it's not clear what the judge said in this case. And he should have used the CPA for
it. I think Ms. Esposito, the way I read her brief, says that there was concedes that there was a miscalculation and it should have been $28,894 as the number that should have been used. That's how I read it. She can tell me if I'm wrong in the way that I read it or not. But the bottom line is, assuming for the sake of discussion that the trial judge did miscalculate it, that it isn't $39,000 plus, but rather it's $28,000 plus, could the trial judge still have gotten to the $1,000 figure, notwithstanding the miscalculations to what your client's income was?
I don't see how he could have gone as far as that goes. Like $800 or $900 gross per month difference, I think he could not have gotten to that figure if he was trying to balance out the sides. And that's what you could look at. When I looked at it, put it that way, it sounds like he was trying to. He said she had not been actively employed and not sought employment at all. But he gave her a $1,200 a month income and then said $1,000 child support, and then he lowered down Mr. Perez's income by $3,200 to $1,000 and tried to get him even, I guess is what he's trying to do. But he would not have put out to that level, I think, in my opinion. And then moving on to the third argument of Ken on the issue of the equitable distribution in this case, the court seemed to focus on the fact that Mr. Moretz sold assets without court approval. He would have the word not to do so. But that was after he filed bankruptcy, and the bankruptcy court came into play too, in which he was trying to liquidate assets at that point in time. Bankruptcy case actually pending went on until like 2014. Highland Bank was a secured creditors case, and it approved these sales. Went off at that point, and the money went to the bank. But the court didn't take into consideration that amount of money, and there was no real equity in there that Mrs. Moret lost from these properties. And I think it was error for the court not to give credit for that. I see that the yellow light is on. I don't know how many minutes that is left, but I can reserve the rest of the time. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. So, Faith Esposito, counsel for Karen Moret. If it please the court, I was involved in the case in 2011. I hadn't been in long at that point, but there was an evidentiary hearing in circuit court in 2011 that prompted that order that the court entered, failing to modify the order of 2007 or 2009. We had a full hearing. Mr. Moret presented evidence as to his income and earnings at that time, and that resulted in this hearing, in this order that was entered in 2012, denying his motion to amend. And if you follow the course of what Mr. Lamby would ask you to do here, just because there were three motions to amend filed in that period of time, from the first pending daylight order to this next pending daylight order, the court would have to hold three separate hearings on each of those motions in order to dispose of them. And that doesn't make any sense. The court heard full evidence and entered a new order saying there's no reason to change this order back that we entered pendente light in 2009. In addition to that, there was another hearing in October of 16, which really represented the final hearing in this divorce case, where both parties were allowed to present evidence as to their incomes and their current statuses. Mr. Moret failed to do that, and this goes to the argument not only to spousal support, but child support as well. Mr. Moret did not present evidence of his income other than an estimate at that point, because he said he had filed a delayed tax return, which was due in October. We had the hearing on October 16th. He still did not have his information of income to present to the court at that time. So the court is left with its hands tied, essentially, looking to the demeanor, the credibility of the witness, all of this convoluted evidence that took place over the years from Mr. Moret as to what his income actually was. He did testify that the cattle business had recovered.
Let me stop you there.
Yes, sir.
Do you agree or disagree that the trial court apparently used the wrong number, and that the income should be should be 28,894 rather than 39,276.
I don't concede that, Your Honor, because the court took the evidence from more than one source. The 28,000 was Mr. Moret's estimate of what his income would be that year, but he provided no information.
Where did the 39,276 come from?
The 39,276 came from the bankruptcy file. And so he and the court also looked at evidence of the accountant who testified at length about what his actual income was as opposed to what he was claiming. He would claim, for example, that his income was $23,000, but the accountant then would testify, no, if you add back the depreciation, which is actually cash value, he has that cash available of $136,000. So I think what the court did was to take into account all of these sources of income that Mr. Moret had testified to over the course of several years.
Where did the trial court say that it was using the 39,276 from the bankruptcy petition? Is that in the record somewhere?
I believe, let me find his order here. Yes, sir. In his memorandum opinion is where that should be found, and I believe that might have been on page 92 of the appendix. Here we go. He actually said 3273 per month.
Right.
Or 28,894 estimated per year. And that actually may be a mistake on the court's part.
That's what I was asking, because the numbers don't add up. It's got to be one or the other.
Right. I think that might be a mistake on the court's part in just simple calculation.
So the 28,894 is the right number.
That's the number that Mr. Moret estimated that he would be making. There was no evidence of that presented at the October hearing, however. That was simply an estimate on his part. And I think the court looked at that, but I think the court also looked at all of the factors that it set forth in its memorandum opinion, like the fact that he testified that the cattle business had recovered, both parties had more earning capacity than they had had in the past, he had recovered from his illness. There were several factors that the court actually looked at, I think, in making the determination of spousal support. In addition to the factors that the wife had worked in and out of the home, raised four children, had been almost a 20-year marriage at that point. So all of the factors that should have been considered, I think the court did properly consider, and in the court's discretion made what I thought was more than reasonable amount of spousal support per month, based on what the court saw from 10 years of testimony and evidence in this case. In responding quickly to Mr. Lammy's argument about the items that were sold in opposition to the court order that was down. First of all, the debt, the court clearly on page 92 of the appendix considered the debt of the parties. He went on at great length about the fact that most of the debt was post-separation. The big debt that Mr. Moret was applying these sums to was post-separation debt, where he had borrowed money to buy this property after they separated. The court had a clear order down, you are not to sell or dispose of any marital assets. He disposed of all of them. All he had to do was go ask the court for permission to sell these items and let the court approve the sale. He couldn't remember who he sold things to. He couldn't remember what he sold things for in some instances. And all of this in direct violation of the court order. And I think he was absolutely proper to give her credit and equitable distribution for those things that they had acquired during their marriage and that he sold outside of the limitations of what the court had allowed him to do, bankruptcy or not. The bankruptcy ended without the bankruptcy court ordering any of those things to be sold. They were released and discharged, and he sold them on his own. And if you look at the testimony of the bank officials in this case, Mr. Dickinson, he said, well, I don't really remember whether we told him he could sell them or should sell them. We should have approved them, but I'm not sure that we did approve them. Didn't know where they had gone. Thought he had applied some of the proceeds.
Did the bankruptcy ever go through?
The bankruptcy was discharged.
Okay.
It was finished.
Okay, this was chapter 7, chapter 11.
I'm sorry, I can't remember which of those.
I'm not a bankruptcy attorney, but typically when you're in bankruptcy, there's a preclusion for selling off assets, isn't it?
There, and in this case, I think they released these assets at the end of the day. They didn't take any of them, didn't require that any of them be sold, is my understanding. And we paused the divorce case essentially until that bankruptcy was fully discharged.
Was there a stay?
There was a stay. We did put the brakes on everything while that went on.
Okay.
Yes, we did. And in the end, when it was over, he still had these assets. And he still sold these assets. And I'm not a bankruptcy attorney either, but it was my understanding through counsel that that was permissible at that point. And the judge agreed with us on that. So, but in the end, I think the equitable distribution was more than fair under the circumstances, and there's no evidence that there was any abuse of discretion in this case whatsoever. This court suffered through this case as we did for many years, some of us more than others, and we finally thought we had a reasonable conclusion to it. I might add, too, that in the order, I'm of the position that counsel did not assign error to any amounts going beyond after 2012, August of 2012. That assignment of error was simply to not to matters before, but to matters after 2012. And then at the last hearing we had, support enforcement was present, evidentiary hearing, took all the evidence, calculated the arrears based on the children, where they lived, how long they lived there, and what the incomes were during that period of time. I don't think there's any error whatsoever in those calculations either. And I might say that there was no objection by Mr. Moret's attorney at the time to the order in 2011 that denied any modification back from that earlier order. It was entered without objection from his attorney. So I would argue that nothing, aside from Virginia law and the case law that is pretty clear about going back behind orders that are entered, especially pendente light orders in this case. Your Honor, thank you. If you have no other questions, that's all I have.
Questions?
Thank you.
I'll cut down a minute or two. Addressing things, first of all, in regard to the bankruptcy, it was a Chapter 7 in the case. All these assets were subject to bank lien, and therefore the court granted relief to let the debtor go ahead and sell those for Highland Union Bank in that case. So they didn't represent anything that had equity in them for the bankruptcy estate, which I think is an important fact to consider in this case. But so there had been no equity for Mrs. Moret either at that point in time as far as it goes. In regard to this debt, counsel argues that this debt was post-separation. The parties bought right about the same time as they separated property on the Holston River for a farm and to build a house with it. And it was contracted for, it was in both names. It was not just in Mr. Moret's name, it was in both names. And some of the debt that existed before the bankruptcy, but some of the debt came up during that time period of that purchase, they completed that sale. And now, what their plans were in 2006, I don't know, but that property was a jointly held property, which I think equates that debt to being necessary for the, that Mrs. Moret had some responsibility for too, in regard to the equity that that house and the property there was. In regard to the order on, again, counsel argues about going behind the order especially conditioned like orders in this case. The trouble with that is that we are actually doing just that. We're reading into something that's not there. We're reading in there and it says, you know, all the court did after hearing that evidence of 2011 says, I still see a reason for changing the January 2009 order, which is without prejudice. So we still have that order there. It's a strange conundrum, but that's where we are with it in regard to the matter with it. And in regard to Mr. Dickinson, the Highland Union Bank officer testified, he testified that the bank signed off on these plans. Transactions. We brought in, one of the witnesses in this case was a Russell Swyback, who was from Iowa, who was a driver known to Mr. Moret. He came in and bought a Harley Davidson motorcycle. He testified that, and it's in the record, that he dealt with the bank on the sale of that asset directly. That's where he came up with the price on. The bank had to make sure that things sold for as much as possible. Mr. Rupp was trying to cooperate with the bank to get these assets sold. And as at that point in time, he was trying to reserve equity in the real estate, in this joint land on the river, which totally failed because it ended up being foreclosed upon in that case as well. But again, we think the court should reverse the finding by the judge both on the support issues and also on the ample distribution issues in the legal stage. We appreciate your attention.
Thank you, Mr. Laney. We'll come down and greet counsel, and I would remind everyone to please sign your those signing sheets that are up front. Thank you.